All right, at this time I'd like to introduce the first speaker, Corey H. from Sunday Recovery in the South Hills area of NA. Or Shazna.
What's up, Corey? I'm an addict.
Hey, Corey.
Clean dates, January 23rd, 2011. Start with that, because that was a really... That was a day in my life where I had no control of my life. And the police in Northside had control of my life, and my higher power was in control. And there's a lot of puppeteers with strings on me who got me to where I was at. I was incapable of being honest. I was completely closed-minded. And the only willingness I had was to not feel the way I felt. So I had to just put one in me. I got arrested that day, and during my arrest, I was really angry and I was really aggressive with the police. And they gave me a really good beating that day. You know, and looking back now, I 100% fully deserved it, because if I had to arrest me in that state, I'd have been terrified. You know, I wasn't making sense. I was spitting. I was like, you know what I mean? And not only have I forgiven them, but like I call the arresting officer on my clean date. And I thank him. And he's always like, dude, who is this? He's like, you know how many people I arrest? And you know, my sponsor just says, like, there's so many things that happen in the universe. Like, the course of events that got me clean could never be duplicated again. I truly believe that God was working through the Northside Police to get me clean that day. And this guy doesn't even know he was a vessel. He doesn't know. I was just another arrest. And I started off in ACJ that night. I was an animal. I was that dude in holding that everyone talked about. They put me in the room. I'm the dude who bashed his face against the wall, the glass. I spit on the guards. I tried killing myself. It was about a 4-hour screaming marathon of just obscenities and incoherent babble and just insanity. And that was my last day using. I think I tried to pee on a guard. And like, you know, if you know me now, like this isn't who I am. And the reason I was that way was because the way I was living wasn't who I was either. There was this giant tear. It was like ripping a steak in half. It's kind of how I was living my life. I wasn't supposed to be that person, which is where all the anger and angst and anxiety and frustration and all those feelings I was feeling to try and suffocate with drugs were coming from. And so I got to the cell that night, and they put me in the turtle suit naked up in 5C. And I finally woke up around 4 in the morning. And this guard took kindness on me. Like, for some reason, this guard came in, and he, like, opens the door, and he's like, if I come in, are you going to bite me? I was like, no. I was finally exhausted from my own anger. And he's like, if I take off this suit, and will you put on some clothes? I was like, yeah, because I was, like, naked. You have to wear, like, a little Kevlar vest on. And he did that. And that was the first kind act anyone had done for me in a long time without any expectation. Well, he had an expectation of not getting bitten. Yeah. But, like, without an expectation or without a motive. Because everyone had motives with me. You know, the owners of the restaurants I worked at always had motives. You know, my ex-wife always had a motive, whether it was just to protect herself from me or to, like, get me to go do something that she didn't want to have to go do what we had to do to get it in. So I spent that day trying to calm down and figure out what I was going to do, because I couldn't really see out of my eyes. They had to super glue my face shut. And when I saw my charges, my stomach sank. And the reason I'm starting off with this story is just because of how I got into the how of the program. I was looking at 3.5 to 7 years minimum. No ifs, ands, or buts. I had so many assault charges before, robberies, you know, what we do, multiple felonies. There was no trying to go to rehab this time. There was none of that. And I knew it was going up Camp Hill. I knew it. And for some reason, that calmed me down a little bit. For some reason, I took solace in that, because I was a nightmare keg of dynamite running around the streets of Lawrenceville, up and down Butler Street. And if you got within 10 feet of me, like, you were in danger. And I'm not saying that, like, I'm just saying, because I would use you, or I would physically attack you, or I would just make you feel uncomfortable, or there's something I would do that you would regret being around me. And, so I sat there in my cell that night. You know, I gave my Reader's Digest of all the drugs I was on. And they looked at me, and the nurse comes in. She's like, "That's great." She put an anti-seizure patch on me. She said, "We'll see you in 4 days." I was like, "Awesome." And I'd been to detox before, and I'd been to rehabs and halfway houses, and I knew there was, like, the easy detox out there, and they weren't giving it to me this time. Because I hit a cop, and I hit some prison guards when I came in there, and they could care less about me. And I sat in a cell that night, and I tried to say the Serenity Prayer. And I really couldn't remember it. It's because that run had been 10 years for me. Last time I was clean was I went out in January of 2000, and I came back to 2011, January 2011. And it's crazy that the mustard seed that got planted in me that young was still there throughout my entire addiction. I remember my ex-wife looking at me, she's like, "You have to stop using." And I said, "I can never stop using without going to the rooms, and if I go to the rooms, you're gone. Because I can't have you in my life." And I said those things. I had those moments of clarity. So I tried saying the Serenity Prayer that night. And I tried getting honest with God. And I will say honestly, I was not a foxhole prayer addict. I didn't waste my time with prayer. Because of what I did on the streets, I didn't think God wanted anything to do with me. I didn't waste my time. There was no, like, "Please get me out of this jam." That was just my story. So, my first chance to get honest was the next morning. This guy, this social worker, talks to me, and he's like, "What happened?" And I wanted so bad to twist and manipulate and tell them how I was attacked by the Northside police officers. "Look at my face. Why isn't anyone taking photographs of me?" That's all I wanted to say, and my only response was, "I'm an addict." And, because that was my response, I was given a chance to get some help. Miraculously, they let me out on an ROR to go get help, because I had such a mental health background too. Because of those 11 years when I was out there, I'd been 302'd so many times and put in so many psych wards where I refused to admit I was an addict. Absolutely refused to admit I was an addict, because I knew as soon as I said those words, it was a wrap. I'd be put into a 12-step program, and I knew once I came into that 12-step program that there was no going back for me. And I was really trying to protect my disease. And so I ended up at this facility, and I still tell people I was the angriest addict ever at this facility. And they held on to me for 81 days. I knew enough about the program from, like, the late 90s and into 2000 to know a couple things. I knew that if I couldn't get honest, I couldn't stay clean. And I had a practice thing. I had a practice being honest at this facility. It wasn't 10 bags, it was 3. It wasn't, "I'm from North Philly," it's, "I'm from Westchester and I used to cop in North Philly." It wasn't, we're talking 10 years of living that same lie to where the point where you believe it. I could pass a lie detector test and tell you I'm from 5th and Indiana. There's only Puerto Ricans there. Like, I mean, I believed it. I believed it. You know, and I will say this. I've never told a lie in my entire life that wasn't 100% based in fear. To this day. Fear of what you think about me. Fear of me affecting you. Fear of me hurting you. Fear of what you think about me. Fear of what you think about me. Every lie I've ever told is based out of fear. You know? You know, even like the ones where I come into a campsite and everyone's like, "How are you?" I'm like, "I'm great." I'm okay. You know what I mean? Like, the disease isn't riding my brain right now, but I'm not great. I tell you that to keep you at a nice distance so we don't have to talk. You know? And why do I say that lie? It's fear of what? Exposing myself, being vulnerable? So I'm at this facility, and I'm practicing being honest. Like, I'm practicing. And that's the best way I can state it. And the first time I worked my way through the steps, I was as honest as I could be at the time. My first four step this time, I barely scratched the surface. You know, I put some stuff on there that I thought... I put some stuff on there that I thought was good, but I wasn't capable of going deep because I wasn't capable of looking at it myself. So this facility, they started telling me about going to another place after I left, because my home in Lawrenceville was gone. My ex-wife was like, she's like, "You're good. We got rid of you. Please don't ever come back. Thank you." And I was really closed-minded because... I put down the needle years ago, right? And then I had picked up 18 other substances. And I literally used to call my mom, smashed out of my mind on, like, pills and vodka on my clean date. We're like, "Ma, I got 7 years off of heroin." And she's like, "Congratulations, honey. What are you doing with your life?" So I walked into this facility really closed-minded, because as soon as you said crack or heroin, that hadn't been my story for a couple years. Now, the 90s, that was my story. Two of them were my best friend. I was judgmental. I couldn't hear what you had to say because I thought I was better than you. And I addressed myself as an alcoholic at this facility because that had just been my most recent drug of choice, even though my drug of choice was more. I couldn't hear what you had to say. I was so close-minded. And that's the defect I suffer from today. I'm finishing up my sixth step again, and I went deep this time. I spent 52 weeks on it this time, a defect a week. And I went deep. And there's a lot of stuff in there I didn't want to admit. There's a lot of times there I didn't want to pick up my pen. I didn't want to get honest, because I knew as soon as I get honest, it would have exposed it to the light and it was over. So some of the counselors would talk to me, and I got a little bit of open-mindedness. You know, open-mindedness is the tool that when I think I know what's going on, and I think I know what's right, and I think I know the best way, the only tool I have to offset that defect is to be open-minded and have the ability to listen to what you have to say. And it doesn't have to come from a recovering addict. I always say this: the crackhead at 7-Eleven has saved my life. You know, I'm sitting there struggling one day down. And this dude just opens the door. He's like, "Sometimes..." I was sitting there trying to get the door open because, like, the suction of the freezer. You guys know what I'm talking about. He's like, "Sometimes you just gotta let it go." Straight up, cracked lips. Straight up, dude, just smoke. It doesn't, you know, like, my God doesn't send the messages all through addicts, man. I hear it all day long. If I can hear, if I'm open-minded enough and not judgmental enough to hear what that person has to say, because. You know, I'm not the type of dude who thinks I'll never sit there and meditate and hear God's voice. But if I can get out of my own way, I can hear His message. So I started listening to what people had to say. And then they told me to go to a halfway house. And I was like, "You know who I am?" Like, "I owned a house in Lawrenceville. I ran restaurants. I ran restaurants into the ground, and I ran my home into the ground. And if you hired me to be your chef, you might as well have, I brought the hood with me. I knew who my busboys were who could rob the servers out of..." I'm like, "Yo, so-and-so just had a great night, all right?" The men's process sucks sometimes. But I picked up a little bit of willingness. I was willing to try and be honest. I was willing to follow some direction. And something happened around, like, day 70 up there. Something happened. I stopped punching the payphone every time I got denied for funding for a halfway house. I stopped kicking the door of the tech shed up there. I started walking on the path. This spiritual and psychic change happened for me. And I started playing softball. And I start laughing. And then not caring that you people saw me laugh because I was so afraid that you weren't going to view me as a tough guy. Because that was my defense. If you saw me in Lawrenceville, you knew from two blocks away that I was coming. I am not a tough guy. I'm a sensitive little boy who, when the world hurts, I just want to put the sheets over my head and cry for my mom. I played that tough guy card so well for so many years. It was to keep you at distance. It's because I hurt so fucking bad inside. I didn't know what to do, and there wasn't enough heroin, crack, or Vladimir on Earth to ever stop that. That was my only line of defense. And there's a lot of things I did that I regret. I've talked about it. I shared about it. My God forgives me for it. I still just need to stop beating myself up for it. That's next. So I got a little bit of willingness. And I'll tell you what. I started getting happy, and then I got a lot of willingness. Because then I had something to protect. I was no longer trying to protect my disease. I had this joy in me. And I could laugh out loud, and people could hear my voice again. And I played softball every day up there. And I can't tell you how much that softball facility saved my life. You know? And then I was there for so long, the techs would let me go work. There was this guy who used to deliver laundry there. And he was in the rooms. They would let me go hang out with him, and we'd drop off sheets to, like, the cabin. And I would just listen to what he had to say. And that's how my journey began. A little bit of honesty, a little bit of willingness, and a little bit of open-mindedness. And by the time I hit the halfway house, I was so terrified to go back to being that savage that I would do anything you guys said. I hit meetings. I got a sponsor. I worked steps in that halfway house. I worked steps for ego in that halfway house, though. I worked steps not to figure out who I am on the inside. I worked steps so at the end of every night when we sat around the circle, I could tell you what step I was on, and I could tell you how to get through the third step. I had like 19 seconds clean, and I'm sitting there coaching people in the halfway house. I worked those steps straight out of ego. You give me a book and some stuff to fill out, I can crush essays. I didn't absorb any of that. My next sponsor went old school and hardcore on me, and that's exactly what I needed. But God bless my first one. He must have just thought I was batshit crazy. He just probably nodded, like, Jesus Christ. But the willingness, you know, like, I think about the how, and when I first got, you know, asked to speak about this, and I was like, I haven't really thought about that in a while, but I suffer with that now. That willingness part, that open-mindedness part, that honest part. I can't get honest with you about how I really feel inside, and nor will I until I'm ready to change. And the only way I'm ready to change on that way I feel inside until I'm embarrassed by it, because I act out on the defect that I'm embarrassed by. And the only way I'll change that defect is for me to be so sick and tired and beat up by that defect and have so much pain that I'm ready to finally do something about it. So I, you know what I mean? Like, this isn't like a new topic to me. This is something I'm suffering from this week. You know, we were just talking around fire last night about willingness. Talking about when we first came in, you know, we're willing to do anything. But I'm not willing today to address, like, my eating issue. I'm not willing today to address my anger, my fear over what I'm going to do for my life as a career, whether I want to work for myself or not. I've been really closed-minded this week, so I suffer from these things. But I have the ability to suffer and know when it's time to stop suffering and speak up, because the closed mouth don't get better. I could tell people I'm great till I'm blue in the face, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting there with a freaking drink in my hand and a pipe in my pocket, wondering what the hell just happened. You know, I live with another addict, and I learn a lot from her, mistakes and, you know, triumphs. But I'll never forget this. She told me that she gave a lead, she called her sponsor, she called three of her sponsees, and then she went down the south side and got drunk. Because she got stuck on a defect for 2 months. That resonated with me. Because I know this person. You know what I mean? It resonated with me. That sometimes is the motivation I use to talk about what's going on. You know, we can be baffled around here. If you don't get honest about something, you'll be sitting in the freaking shooting gallery. If you're too judgmental, you'll never hear what you need to hear to get you another year clean or a day clean. And if you're not willing to work on your recovery, you're like, what are we doing here? It's a 12-step program. If you're not working the steps, like, what are we doing? And I'm not saying that I haven't stalled on the step. But like at some point, we just have to realize it's insanity. I heard an addict share last night, like, coming here and not working steps, it's like going to the crack house to play cards. It just doesn't make sense. But that's my quote for him for the other day. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Corey, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. I'd like to introduce the second speaker, Adrian S., from the We Do Recover group of NA in the Neasna area.
I'm Adrian, I'm an addict.
Adrian.
My clean date is January 12th, 2011. And I say that to remind myself of a place I was at where I do not ever want to go back to. The date coincides with my trial date. I had known for a year when I was going to trial, but I couldn't stop getting high. I'm the kind of addict that has to be stopped. And when I was asked to share on this topic, I was so excited because the spiritual principles are what got me clean and what keeps me clean. I'd started using at about 13 years old, and I used every day for the next 26 years. Every single day. Except, I mean, there was a few days in there where I just could not find any ways and means to get more. And like a few times I was mommy ordered or something like that to treatment. But I always weaseled my way out of, you know, I have to leave. And would amazingly get like, you know, like an honorable discharge. I'd get a completion letter from these treatment facilities I was in. And I remember the first time I was in treatment was Gateway years ago. And the therapist, she flat out told me, she says, you're just simply not ready. And I'm like, you know, you're right. I'm not here because I want to be here. I'm here because my mom made me come here. She was going to throw me out. But, you know, it was wild how I had got there. I had, at one point in my life, you know, I had a college education. I married a guy that was educated. We owned 3 or 4 houses, 5 vehicles, 3 small businesses, had real large bank accounts. And, of course, we were using that whole time. But within a process of 1 year, I had lost everything that it took me the prior 28 years of my life to acquire. Lost it all. I mean, it goes quick. And we'd lived in this house that had a mold problem, and my husband and I both got real sick. And I was going to doctors trying to ask them, you know, trying to find out what's wrong with me. I knew something was wrong with me. You know, not the drugs. That wasn't wrong with me. It was, you know, I had some type of physical ailment going on. And every time we'd go to a different emergency room or a different doctor, they'd give me a urine and tell me the problem was drugs. And I'm like, no, I do drugs. That's just what I do. I've been doing them for my whole life. And that's, you know, I've never had, like, lesions on my skin and chronic pneumonia. Like, you know, something's going on here. And they said I was doctor shopping. I was. I was really doctor shopping looking for freaking antibiotics. I didn't need the doctor to give me drugs. Like, I could find those on the street. You know, because I wouldn't take time out of my day to go to a doctor unless, you know, unless I was really, really sick. But let me start back in my early childhood. I guess I was like an unhappy, timid, shy little girl. From what I can gather, that's what went on in my mind. But on the exterior, I was this controlling girl who ran everything. I was the kind of kid that I would never come to your house and play. Everyone had to come to my house. And they did. That's what the crazy part was. They came to my house, played what I told you we had to play. And when you got mad, I told you to take your ball and go home. Like, and I was really okay with it. And I was a manipulator from early on. Like, I would charge kids $2 a head to come to my house and play. And they paid it. Like, a friend of mine turned me on to that one day, and, like, I ran with it for many years. And then we had this little club. You know, I invented it. It was called the Witches Club. I don't know where I got that from. But so I'd make every kid in the neighborhood say a swear word, and I'd write it in this little book. And put the date you said the swear word, and that became our little snitch book. If you tell on me, I'm going to show your mom this book and tell her that you swore one day. So, like, I was manipulating all these kids But deep down, I felt I had no friends. Like, I felt that I just didn't fit in anywhere. And I was an only child up until I was 10 years old, so I really had things my own way. When my sister was born, I was devastated. Like, we had to share a room, and she touched my stuff. And till this day, I do not like people touching my shit. Like, don't touch. I love you. I might loan you something. You know, I'm just being honest, but I'm probably not going to lend it to you. Because I worked hard for what I have, and, like, I don't know, go get a job and get your own stuff, you know? But I've lent a few friends things. Like, it starts out real small. Like, my one friend, I loaned her a $1 extension cord for Christmas last year, you know, and I didn't get it back. Then I loaned her, like, a cheap coffee pot I probably got out of the garbage or something, and I didn't get it back. So now, you know, she asked me if she can borrow something. The answer's no. But I love her. You know, but I'm stingy. I'm just being honest with you. I'm stingy. And when it comes to willingness, I had no willingness to get clean. I thought that I was going to die a junkie. I was really okay with that. I didn't think there was any possible way to repair all the damage I'd caused in my life. And at first, it was just surface stuff. It was the $250,000 of debt that I'd got myself in. I thought there was just no way to ever get out of that, so I might as well just keep getting high. And then it was, you know, all the other stuff, like, you know, I have no self-respect left, no dignity, no integrity, no home to go back to. You know, there was a point I was living with my aunt, who's also was an active addiction at the time, and people were saying, you know, you left your house because you're a junkie. That is why I left my house, but I still owned the house, and I really left because I was sick. And I tell people, do you think I chose to live with this woman? I could still stay in my house, but I couldn't. I couldn't stay there, even though I owned home. So here's what I did. We rented all our properties out to dealers, and that's how they would pay me rent on the first of the month. And by that night, it was all gone. It was all gone, and now I'm back to being homeless for the next 29 days of the month, and lived like that for a really, really long time. And I became okay with it. You know, that's what was really sad, that I was okay with that. I really thought that I was doing my community a service. I really did. From the first time I started getting high, at 13 years old, whatever my drug of choice was during that era, I sold that drug. So I figured, as long as I'm getting mine for free, it's not a problem. And he would think it's a problem. I'm not paying anything, even though my life was totally unmanageable. You know, I was just thinking about this morning. I'm by myself on my way up to the bathroom. All the drugs I put in my system, and I'm healthy today. Like, I can remember every single day going to work for probably a 10-year time period of being hungover to the point, you know, I should have probably been in the hospital doing liver damage. And just, I was poisoning myself, getting alcohol poisoning, and going to work. But yet my liver's fine today. You know, that's God. It's a miracle that I ended up as a healthy person, that we all did. It's truly amazing that we ended up here. But so my husband and I would get arrested because eventually the drugs got harsher and harsher. We had to sell more and more drugs. And we started a quite lucrative heroin operation. And we got arrested. He goes to jail because he's on probation, so he's detained. And I'm like, yes, I can have it all to myself now. And I knew the day was coming that we were going to get arrested. It was never a question of if I get busted. It was just a question of when. So long ago, I'd had a lawyer on retainer because I knew the day was coming. Just for me, though, not for him, because I couldn't part. Because here's what happened. He got, like, one more bag of something once than I did. And for the next 20 years, I held a resentment against him for that. And, you know, I couldn't have that. I had to have more. I always had to be the most. I had to be the highest. So we go to jail, and he stays in jail, and I get out. And we were making a whole lot of money at the time, a lot of money. No utilities in our house, none. And I tried to convince myself that it was on principle, because he did that one extra bag one time, I'm not going to get the utilities turned on. But in actuality, you know, I was a junkie. Why did I need utilities? I'm not taking a shower, ever, because you're going to steal my shit if I'm in the shower, or I'm going to miss a snap if I'm in the shower. So that was, like, totally out of the question, ever getting a shower. So I didn't need water. You know, I needed to drink water, but I guess that never entered my mind. Like, and I really thought I was honest. I convinced myself of that. But even as a child, I was grimy. I was always stealing stuff. But I wasn't stealing, like, from people. I'd steal from stores. So I justified it. That was okay. And every job I ever had, I cleaned them out. I was always an office manager somehow, or working in accounts payable where I worked at. So every office supply order for any company I worked at, like, I was jealous. Well, they can order $300 worth of office supplies. I need that shit, too. Listen, by the time I got clean, I think I had 3,000 packs of Post-it notes, 1,500 paper clips. I still have a basement filled with office supplies. I'm never going to use that shit, but I had to have it just because I was jealous. If someone else had it, I felt that I had to have it. But I thought I was a good person because I didn't burn people. Like, if someone asked me to go cop for them, I'd give them what they paid for and make them give me a cut. But that wasn't about being honest. It was all about me. I wanted to make sure I hooked you up because I needed you to call me again tomorrow so I could get high. It had nothing to do with you. I thought that I was honest because I would never serve somebody that had their kids with them. In my mind, I thought I'm protecting these kids. That wasn't it. I just didn't want to catch an additional charge of child endangerment when I went to jail. So it really had nothing to do with you or your kids. It was all totally about me. So whenever we get arrested, my husband gets detained, and of course I call my lawyer who has my bond money, and I get out of jail. And it's real sick. I call my mom to come down and get me, but I tell her she has to pick up the dope man on the way because I'm dope sick. And, you know, I manipulate her into doing this. And she does it. Like, she picks up the drug dealer in the north side to pick me up. And I can't wait till I get to his house because I'm not waiting for anything. And I do it in her car. Then I'm throwing up all through her car. And she's crying. And I'm telling her, you know, just deal with it. This is what happens in the life of drugs. Because it was acceptable for me. So I thought it should be acceptable for you, too, the way that I lived. I thought nobody else should have a problem with it because... like, I thought I was cool. I really thought I was cool for so long. It was sickening. So I'm all excited. My husband's in jail, and I'm out of jail. And I'm like, look at all these people that think I'm such an upstanding person. Bunch of dope dealers come over, giving me some money to pay my bills, fronting me some stuff. It wasn't about me. It was about me flipping their shit to make them rich. It had nothing to do with me. But, you know, I thought I was cool. These people trust me. So I kept doing the same thing I was doing. And I go to court one day, and they tell me I'm facing a mandatory minimum of 2 to 4 years. And I'm like, you know what? I tell my lawyer, I said, dude, I never did ARD. Like, I've been saving ARD. I think we can use ARD for this case. And I was convinced of that. Because years ago, I got arrested. And I don't know how many people get arrested for this. Should I photocopy the coupon? And when it says on the bottom of that coupon, like, it's copyrighted or do not copy or register trademark or something, they were serious. I got arrested in New Kensington for that, and they tried making me use ARD then. And I didn't tell them this, but I thought in my mind, ooh, I'm going to have something bigger coming down the pike. Like, I'm not using the ARD for this. I'll take the probation. So when I asked my lawyer for ARD, he's like, honey, this is a mandatory minimum case. Like, there is no ARD. He says, no matter what happens, you're going to get clean. I'm like, you're fired. Like, there's got to be another option. Like, getting clean wasn't in the cards. I just could not see that happening. Couldn't see it happening. So, my husband, we're co-defendants, and he's pretty cased up, so he's facing a mandatory minimum of 5 to 10. So, finally, he comes to the house one day from the halfway house, and he says, if you don't take what they offer you, I'm going to kill you. And not that that really affected me or anything, but... you know, that might have been my spiritual awakening. Because I really didn't give a shit what he did or what happened to him. I'm like, you go do your 5 to 10 or 7 up to 15. So I was convinced that doing 2 to 4 years was cool. Like, I was just, my perception was so distorted, I thought that I could do my time and get out and continue getting high. Because, like, I couldn't stop by myself, and I just couldn't foresee ever stopping using. So we both go in to a drug court assessment. My lawyer had referred me to drug court. And I go in there and they tell me, you're going to stop getting high. That was the last thing I heard that they said. I bawled like a baby and I'm crying. And these people are like crying with me. The people that work for the courts. And they're talking all nice to me. We're going to get you help. Why are you going to do something for me? Like, what is in it for you? I just didn't think that respect was available to me out there. I didn't deserve any respect. So I decided, okay, I'll do it. So they told me, you have to get into treatment before your trial date. But I was on so many drugs. Oh, and I did come up with, I'm going to get on methadone. And that's how I'm going to get out of this case. Well, so now I have 15 other substances I'm hooked on, and now I'm hooked on methadone too. Because I didn't stop doing anything else. So no treatment facility would take me because I'm on such a high milligram of methadone. And I'm like, yeah, nice. See, I'm not going to have to go to treatment. Like, they're just going to have to let me do house arrest. It didn't work like that. When they told me treatment or jail, the day I went to my trial... they said, honey, you know, you're going to jail. I knew I was going, though. I knew it was coming. I was fully prepared to go. I literally couldn't wait to go to jail. Because I'm thinking maybe just maybe I can live one day without having to get high. But no, I wasn't really all that willing because I packed my woman purse with a condom full of multiple pills to take in, and I thought I'm going to ease through this detox. You know, I'll take a couple pills a day, and it'll be all right. So, my celly, that's the first time I ever had like a celly, I guess that's what we call them, and she's like, well, you know, when you go to a program, they're going to give you a urine. Like, and if you're still dirty, they're going to know you were using in jail. Well, that just told me, do all your shit right now today. Do it now. So, that's what I did. It did not ease that withdrawal, not one bit. Then I started getting comfortable in jail because I didn't have to look over my shoulder anymore. Didn't have to worry about how I'm going to get the next one. Like, there was air conditioning and heat and water. I thought, you know, for me, jail was a come up. So then the girl that is my cellie starts telling me about this treatment facility I'm going to go to. It's a 6-month treatment facility. And I don't know about you, but to me, that seemed like the 2 to 4 years. She's telling me all this stuff that, you know, you get up at 6 in the morning and you cook. And I never did none of that shit. Like, I don't get up when I'm supposed to get up. I pass out and then I wake up whenever. I don't cook food. I was petrified. Like, these are things that normal people do in life. That, you know, they live life. And I was so scared. Even that one time I'd done normal things in life, I didn't think I was able to do it again. And so I called my friend who was a drug dealer. I'd left him some money before I went to jail, and I said, look, they're going to be releasing me today. Rehab's picking me up. I want you to meet me at a red light, and I'm going to jump out and meet me with some drugs and a plane ticket. And he immediately said, yeah, okay. And he calls my husband and says, you know, your wife plans on running. So thank God that got nipped in the bud. Like, it's bad when the dope man says, like, I will never cop for your wife again, ever. Like, tell her, don't even call me. And it was so cool, this dude didn't even keep my money. Like, when I went to treatment, he brought me $100 a week. How nice is that? I was that screwed up that he said, honey, you know, I'll help you out in any way that I can. So I get to this treatment facility, and they say, rate your family dynamic. I'm like a 10 out of 10. We're great. I cop for my two sisters. I left them a bunch of shit before I left, so they're not going to have to go out and get their own. I pay everyone in the family's bills. Don't pay my own because I don't need utilities, but like my mom needs utilities and my sister does because she got a kid. And I thought our family dynamic was just wonderful. And now my husband's in jail. Life's good. And see, I blamed him for everything. Everything was his fault. That was my distorted perception. So I'm in this treatment facility, and as time's going on, like, things are starting to become a little more clear. You know, people were washing their clothes and getting up and going to meetings, and they told me that I had to get a sponsor and make 2 support calls a week. Oh, my God. The only calls I knew how to make was, what you got, what you need. That was it. That's the only things I knew how to say. And what do I call someone and say? Just, like, sit there and be dead on the other line? Like, they literally had to force me to call people. And I don't get it because, see, I used to drink, I guess, to come out of my shell and talk a lot and be social. But for about my first 18 months of recovery, I couldn't speak to anyone. I didn't know how to formulate a sentence. So I'm in this treatment facility, and it's 6 months long, and I'm starting to get some recovery, and some girl drops $40 in the bathroom one day. And she had like 6 kids, and she was really poor, and I had my old dope man bringing me my $100 every week, so I had some money. And I picked that money up, and I walked out, and I said, hey, did someone lose money in the bathroom? Well, of course, everyone. Yo, I did. So I said, all right, what denominations is it? And the one girl that's real poor told me that she lost 2 20s in the bathroom, and I gave it to her. Man, like, I felt great. I felt like $1 million. You know, that's what non-addict people do. They return something. But for me to do that to somebody, give their money back when they're, you know, really in need of their money, I just was so overwhelmed. I thought I deserved like a freaking gold star, you know? But that feeling, I remembered that feeling. So I started continuing to be honest. And then that open-mindedness, when people were telling me that, because I blame my husband for everything, and when people were trying to tell me, you know, that I played a part in things, it took me a good 18 months to realize that I did play a part. Now, with 5.5 years clean, I realize I didn't just play a part. I played every part in the whole movie. I was the director. I was the producer. I was the financier. You know, it was all me. I did it all. And I'm okay with that now. Now I try to just kind of, you know, sit back in the shadows, go with the flow or whatever. I run with a couple things, but, you know, I just sort of try to go with the flow. But I don't know, so it was wild. So I blamed my husband for a lot of stuff. And, like, I was still calling my lawyer after I was clean, telling him, like, look, man, this dude's living in my house. Because, of course, it's my house. You know, we're married. We bought it, but everything's mine. And I'm going to try to get him out of my house. What do I need to do? And everyone keeps just saying, be patient, be patient. So I was real blessed that drug court kept us apart for 2 years. And finally, I moved back home, and I'm still scared and shy. And I thought, like, you people knew everything about recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. And I was afraid to even get up here and say, I'm Adrian and I'm an addict, because I thought I might say it wrong. And Yins would, like, laugh at me. But today I know I can say it wrong. And not only is laughing at me, Yins is laughing with me. That's what I like today, that you can laugh with me and I can laugh with you, because there was nothing funny ever whenever I was using. So my husband and a couple other people in recovery come to my house the day I get home. And they kind of forced me into going to area service. And thank God they did. That's where I learned to become the woman that I am today. They just throw me in this room with all these people. I don't know any of them. There's subcommittees going on everywhere. And I have no idea what's going on. So I'm standing there for a couple minutes like this. You're like scared to death, thinking the more I shriek down, maybe no one will see me. And nobody's like coming over telling me what to do. So I had to start walking table to table. What subcommittee is this? What's that? I sit down with public information my first day there. And they're voting on something. And they ask me how I was voting. I'm like, whoa, like, I get a vote here? You know, like, I never got a vote on anything, ever. I was just always along for the ride. Next thing you know, somehow I get forced into H&I subcommittee. And now I get a nomination, like, to take a meeting into a facility that I had graduated from. I said, ain't this some shit? You know? So not only did I get the nomination, they elected me. I couldn't believe it. Then further along, they elect me as vice chair of H&I, then chair of H&I. Now let me tell you, I didn't know shit. I had no clue what's going on in H&I. I get that policy book and I'm reading it, but people are telling me just be open-minded. You know, just ask questions. Learn how to be humble. And that's where I learned that we all don't know everything that's going on. That's why humility is so important. We have to open our mouth and ask. And that's what I did. A couple times, you know, I was embarrassed. I really stuck my foot in my mouth because I think that I know what's going on all the time. And I really don't. But that's how I learned to ask people. And what I love about area service, someone there might not know the answer. It might not be in our policies. But guess what we do? We take a vote on it. We write a new motion. Like, it's really not that difficult. And I made life so difficult. But for this willingness part, it's really affected me today. I have no willingness to quit smoking cigarettes. You know, the drugs were killing me. I couldn't stop. I had to be stopped. I'm really scared on how I'm going to be stopped at smoking cigarettes. Like, is it going to take till I lose a lung? I have emphysema. I have COPD. And I go to the lung doctor, and after 2 seconds of a conversation, I'm exaggerating, 2 minutes of a conversation, as I'm leaving, I ask him if he'll order me Chantix or order me something, and he says no. I'm like, well, you're a lung doctor. You know, why won't you order me this? He says, because you're not ready to quit. I said, how can he tell that, you know, by the two-minute conversation that I had with him? I don't know. I guess it was totally apparent in the way I was behaving. I was probably sitting in his office smoking a cigarette. Like, two weeks ago, we have an event at a recovery center near my house. I had a patch on my arm, a cigarette in my hand, and my vape hanging around my neck. Like, I look like a complete ass, but I can't stop. I wish there was a detox to quit smoking cigarettes. Or, like, I mean, I don't know if it's going to take me going to jail, maybe, where I'm without them a couple days. Because when I was in jail, it wasn't the drugs I was craving anymore. It was a cigarette. If I could only have a cigarette, everything will be all better. One more cigarette and everything will be better. So, I don't know. I need to start praying for some willingness in that area because, you know, it's not looking good. My dad has one lung. My mom is about ready to be on oxygen. And see, when I was getting high, like, a genuine concern of mine was, man, when I'm old in a nursing home, how am I going to cop? I would like, drive past the nursing home every day by my house and really try to formulate a plan on how maintaining a habit was going to work out for me when I'm in a nursing home. You know, it's sick. So now, the other day I'm talking to some people, and I'm like, I'm like, we don't really see a lot of people come into the rooms with visible handicaps. And I was at a meeting a couple weeks ago in Katanning, and I saw a gentleman there that had two artificial legs. I'm like, wow, he's really brave, but, you know, maybe it was an accident or something like that. How am I going to look dragging around my freaking oxygen tank because of self-inflicted damage? Because I won't stop smoking. I don't understand how there's not thousands of people in a room that aren't on oxygen tanks. Like, is it just me or what? So now I feel like a total heel because I just don't, I don't have the open-mindedness or the willingness in this area. And my husband quit smoking, who was like a 2-3 pack a dayer. And he one day says he's going to quit, and he quits. Now I'm like, come on, now if this dude can quit smoking and I can't, now I feel like a real loser. But something's got to give. I don't know. I just got to keep praying about it. Because if an addict like me can get clean and stay clean, I feel sure that I can quit smoking. Thanks.